Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of Hidden Noise. I'm Abby Sandler.
And I'm Rebecca Siegel. And what Abby is not telling you is that she had mouth surgery 2 days ago. So we're going to cut her a little slack and start by saying that we are absolutely delighted that so many of you are listening to the first episodes of this very new podcast. Many thanks for tuning in, and the most thanks to our wonderful guests for sharing their time and expertise with us. This will be the last episode of 2017, so if you're new to Hidden Noise, you've got plenty of time to backtrack and get some good advice on shows to see over the holiday break. First up for today's episode is our go-see, Gordon Matta-Clark at the Bronx Museum of the Arts.
Thank you for the disclaimer, Rebecca, and I apologize to our audience because if I sound like I'm on painkillers, it's because I'm probably on painkillers. So then we're going to swing through Chelsea, where Evens editor Jason Farrago spoke to painter Jacqueline Humphreys, and finally to Queens. For this week's Even 8, we are joined by Peter Ely, chief curator of MoMA PS1.
But first, up north. Way up north. The Bronx Museum is not a cute name for a museum secretly in Harlem. It's 3 blocks away from Yankee Stadium, though I suspect you haven't dropped by on your way to a game.
Here we go. Before I can tell you why Matta-Clark is an exhibition worth the trek, Rebecca's going to tell you a lot about the Bronx Museum.
Yes, I am, because part of Hidden Noise is about understanding New York's cultural landscape. And the Bronx Museum is a really important story. The museum was founded in 1971 at a time when the Bronx was literally in ruins. Some of you baseball fans out there may remember that the Bronx's burning was a story from the World Series. A lethal combination of disastrous urban planning and even worse housing policy, so that between 1970 and 1980, there are statistics from the census that estimate over 40% of the neighborhood was burned or abandoned.
So just to be clear, this isn't the story of the Fifth Avenue Museum mansions. For the first decade, this museum was housed in a courthouse, and from the early 80s, it was in an old synagogue.
The shows at the time were what we now call pop-up, short-term, off-site, spread throughout the neighborhood. And here, the story of the Bronx Museum becomes, in many ways, the story of Holly Block. She joined the museum in 1985 and was responsible for setting the pace, prioritizing community outreach and audience development. Holly eventually became the director of the Bronx Museum, and she was a legend in the New York art world. She found a way to get some of the world's greatest artists to come up to the Bronx. Art from Cuba was a particular interest, and she built deep connections to the local community. She even succeeded in getting the museum to have free admission, which makes a huge difference. When Holly died this past October, the New York art world lost one of its greats.
And Holly's mission very much lives on. Most of the staff listed on the Bronx Museum's website is not curatorial or collections-based. It's dominated by directors of education programs, community engagement, and liaisons to government and institutional giving.
Right, this museum understands its priorities. And the building makes them clear, too. It's actually hard to overstate how unmonumental this building is. I'm accustomed to walking into museums that are like churches. The architecture tells you where to go. It practically forces it on you. The entrance to the Bronx Museum looks like a Midtown CVS.
Well, I wouldn't exactly put it that way, but yes, you enter through revolving doors. There's a desk covered in sign-in sheets and a small cafe kiosk with a handful of tables and chairs.
And it is above that kiosk coffee maker where the main show's wall text is posted. You'll read about Gordon Matta-Clark and then head up a few stairs through unmarked double glass doors to the exhibition's first room. That room has a film in it, and on the other side of that film is another set of double glass doors, which may lead you to believe that you have accidentally entered the show the wrong way, that you're going through it backwards, that you missed the lead. You actually didn't.
Let's start with some basics. Gordon Matta-Clark is probably one of the most important artists of the 1970s. Having graduated from Cornell School of Architecture in 1968, Matta-Clark returned to New York City, where he began developing a series of site-specific actions and interventions, taking his background and using it to call into question basic assumptions about architecture. These actions and interventions had been labeled as, quote, dangerously ambiguous, because they were often both creative and wildly destructive. We're not talking about removing a door here and there. We're talking about blasting holes through walls and cutting out floors of abandoned apartment buildings.
And despite some of my qualms with the structure, the show is pretty fantastic. That is why we're sending you to the Bronx, after all. Photos of the neighborhood, graffiti, sculpture, well, removed floors as sculpture, and there's an extraordinary amount of documentary film, ones we had never seen about projects we had only read about in textbooks.
And there's a very strong argument to be made for why this show is at the Bronx Museum in the first place. Mata Clark's first works, his entire mission, had a heavy presence in the South Bronx. It served as a location for many of his architectural interventions, and this was no coincidence. As Rebecca mentioned, the South Bronx had experienced a fast and steep decline starting around the mid-1960s. Mata Clark actively drew attention to the hollowed, abandoned spaces everywhere in the neighborhood. His politically charged interventions were not about establishing a new architecture like some of his forefathers and contemporaries. He instead took it upon himself to address a failing system at a time when no one was doing anything to make it better. He made people pay attention to what was happening to the fabric of New York City.
Yes, absolutely. And it should also be said that this was at a time when many artists who were also working with space were actually working with nature. They were creating land art while Gordon Mata Clark was becoming a social activist. And I think the Bronx Museum has addressed its mission extremely successfully in that activism. Attendance has grown something like threefold since the building opened. The space allocated for educational programs is beyond reproach, and there's an undeniable sense that you could drop in at any time, even for 5 minutes.
Yeah, like on our first visit to the show, a young family was just walking in and out, reading the wall text, watching the videos, went to get a coffee. And Holly Block announced an expansion effort in 2016.
Yes, but before the building expands, and as we continue to talk about museums and museum architecture and museum missions, one of the things I'm asking myself, and I hope you guys are too, is ultimately, what is the role of a museum right now? And what is the difference between a museum and a community center? Or more to the point, what's the difference between a museum and a community center with arts programming?
I get what you're saying. It can be confusing to have such flat architecture in a museum, but only if you're accustomed to grand staircases and converted mansions, or the contemporary equivalent.
Yeah, like the Whitney, where the grand staircase isn't spatially grand, but is usually lit by Felix Gonzalez Torres' work.
And that staircase currently leads you to the Laura Owens exhibition, well, most of it, on the fifth floor. Go to the Owens show, since you're already in the building, for our go-see from last month, Toyin Ogio Dotola. But now let's talk about Jacqueline Humphreys.
Well, first we're going to talk about what Jacqueline and Laura have in common, what some art historians and critics want to call the digital turn in painting. I'm not going to bore you, but there are a lot of ways artists come to painting. Some love the physical material of paint. Some love tradition. Others want to break tradition and all of the rules of a square canvas. There are a lot of options. But there is a small, massively influential group of mid-career women, among them Laura Owens and Jacqueline Humphreys, who are at the forefront of digital painting.
Humphreys is interested in the proliferation of images and how that proliferation infiltrates our lives now in ways it never did before. We use images as language now. Emojis have replaced words.
We also spend all day looking at screens, two-dimensional, just like canvases. In many ways, paintings are quite close to screens today. You know when the surface of your phone is filthy and you can see all the streaks across it? That's painting. Actually, those are brushstrokes. Jacqueline is playing with those layers, the image you see on your phone and the fingerprints you leave on top of those images. A quick shout out to Andriana Campbell for that excellent metaphor as well.
So without further ado, here's Jason Farrago with painter Jacqueline Humphreys to discuss emojis and brushstrokes.
Jacqueline Humphreys, you've had a really wonderful show at Green Naftali Gallery here in New York this autumn, and the paintings in this show, which continue a long career of engaging with abstractions, possibilities, I was very interested in the variety of techniques that are exhibited in these paintings, and I think one of the most interesting things for me often about your work is that I can see in individual parts of a painting either the use of a stencil or possibly scraping something away. And yet the actual sort of math of how you get from nothing to the final painting is always very obscure to me. What are the kind of building blocks of paintings as complex as this?
Well, I mean, what you're not seeing in the show is a lot of paintings that didn't work out that I threw out. So that usually when I start a body of work, it's a substantial amount of the time that it takes to make the show is just trying to figure out how to make the paintings. I like, you know, when I'm making new body work to be learning something, always to be sort of climbing the curve of learning. It sort of keeps me engaged, keeps me interested. So with these particular paintings, there were several that where you really do see the kind of maybe more clear traces of the thinking and the process of working out how these paintings could actually be built. I think of my paintings as being built more than painted.
There is an architectural character. Although there are layers, there's not a clear foreground and background relationship ever, nor are the application of something like the stencils of emoji in the case of the current paintings or of ASCII characters is never clearly in a frontal relationship to whatever is going on in the back. There's always a sort of shifting of position from the front to the back and vice versa. How do you do that?
Like, again, it's like I work in layers. So, you know, maybe I'll put down one layer in a painting and, you know, sometimes let it dry, sometimes not, and then do another thing and then maybe re-stencil over that. So I'm kind of sandwiching things between layers, some layers of which are transparent because of the stencils, because it's sort of an open pattern, and others that are more densely kind of wiping that layer. And the idea is, again, as you say, front to back is very important on the, you know, what's this known as the Z-axis, that there's a sense of like the painting is like exerting pressure on the space in this kind of shallow space of like stacked layers, almost like windows on a computer screen.
Like windows on a computer screen is actually a really helpful analogy.
Well, I think like what we're seeing when we look at windows on a screen is, you know, essentially an Albers painting. We're all making an Albers painting or a Malevich painting in one way or another, you know, consciously or not. Yet we're interacting with that. We're moving things around. We're creating a kind of gestural pattern on this surface. And in a sense, I started thinking of like, well, what if painting began to reflect these sort of daily interactions with, you know, visuality or the visual realm that maybe now most of us are interacting with
on a daily basis, on a minute by minute basis.
On a minute by minute basis, and, you know, more and more as we keep going on, but that what's constant in the whole thing is the screen. So it's like, you know, the thing about screens now is like images or window, whatever you have, photos, you know, Instagram, images are replacing each other so rapidly that what kind of image would you really commit to painting, since painting is like sort of a fixed thing, right? And it seems like the image that's important is this, you know, rectangle itself. And so that brings you right back to early abstraction.
Absolutely. And I mean, the most interesting and exciting parts of your work, of course, is this deep engagement with a transformation of vision in a digital age without succumbing to the screen itself. I mean, these are still deeply seductive. And this gets to, I think, the most interesting part of the sort of digital versus spatial discussion that we're having, is that all of the consequences of digital culture and all of the consequences of living in a world of screens can only be understood through the perception of a physical object in space. And one of the great pleasures of your painting is that it doesn't photograph very easily. Or if it does, it photographs only in a certain light condition on a certain day. They transform themselves depending on the angle at which you're looking at them, the light conditions in which you're looking at them. They often seem to be almost alive, especially with the use of more metallic colors, with silvery paints, the way in which they reflect. And it's as if they're kind of making an argument that although these are informed by digital matters, a reproduction is not enough.
Yes, that's true. I'm secretly kind of proud of the fact that they can't be photographed. And I think I sort of more consciously now work towards that as an indicator that I'm doing something right. And you know, I don't know how to explain that exactly, except to say again that what I must truly insist on is the life of the painting itself, not images of it in various forms, that essentially it's not available to photography, to Instagram, because you can't see anything or feel anything that the painting really possesses.
The inability to fully capture the experience is the experience that you were going after in the first place, it seems.
Yes, and I guess that's sort of going the opposite way that the entire culture is going. Yet, you know, how else is painting going to be meaningful? You know, it really is, you know, an object made by hands in a room, you know, with one person standing in front of it at a time. And so, you know, if I have to win over the world one person at a time, that's fine.
It is, I suppose, one of the ironies of the revival of painting is that not only the market, but digital reproduction has made painting into, in a weird way, one of the perfect media for a new accelerated global art market. And I don't believe that the response to that is ever, well, therefore, we're not going to do that. Of course not. It's that you take that as the conditions under which you're operating and you try to expand them, escape them, reveal the terms under which this is happening. I think this, for me, gets to what I find so exciting about the current exhibition is that it doesn't run away from the conditions under which we understand painting now so much as it underlines them, it puts them into relief, and then it sort of tries to suggest where one could go. I guess maybe my final question for you could be, you know, does a painter ever find herself in difficulty if you think too much about the conditions of reception or the conditions of viewing? How much of being a painter is just getting lost in the studio and doing the job, and how much of it is thinking about what happens when these things go into the world?
I think I've always thought about the whole thing about the market is an important component of art making, but it's not one that is the finally validating set of principles. I think artists have always been self-validating in the sense that it's not about only about finding approval from others. Like, you know, Manet, for instance, was famously never really commercially successful, but he had art and supporters amongst, you know, people like Baudelaire and Zola, Monet. And, you know, so, and, you know, after his death, of course, we know what happened. So I think the thing about the market is that it can be very distracting, right? Like if you're constantly looking at auction prices and what maybe friends of yours' paintings are getting at auction, then you're really not thinking about what you're in control of. And I think it's very important for artists to sort of observe that, realize it's a part of their world, it's part of the job, part of it in a sense. It's not the sole controlling factor in the life of an artist, you know, even if your work is very actively about that, which mine isn't. I mean, there's certain ways in which my paintings now reflect a certain attitude about that, like maybe a certain kind of like sarcasm or parody has entered. Like there's a sense of like, yeah, that doing things for show is sort of like, you know, problematizes issues of sincerity and authenticity. And
yeah, these become important terms, I guess, in the last sort of 5 or 6 years of your painting, in which the idea that an abstract painting could be funny isn't the right word, but could tweak expectations.
What you wouldn't expect is in serious abstract painting is satire.
Expressed through paint, expressed through form. Jacqueline Humphreys, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
For today's Even 8, we are joined by Peter Ely, Chief Curator at MoMA PS1. Peter has been with the institution since 2010, and before that was at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis and Creative Time in New York. The list of exhibitions that Peter has personally curated, let alone assisted, is practically endless, so I'm going to keep this short to my personal highlights: the Mike Kelly retrospective in 2013 and the recent exhibition of Maureen Galais' painting. Thank you, Peter, for joining us on this very snowy morning.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, Peter, can you tell us a little bit about MoMA PS1 and in Long Island City and where it fits into the larger institution of MoMA, the Midtown staple we all know?
The Midtown mothership. Well, MoMA PS1 was founded as PS1 in 1976 by Lana Heiss in this great old Romanesque public school building, which had been abandoned for a number of years. And she built a remarkable program there over decades, actually, before MoMA was even in the picture. And at the time that the last renovation was happening, which was the construction of the Taniguchi building almost 2 decades ago, the institution, in this case the mothership, was looking for a place to organize temporary programs and found a building in Queens, which we still own and use for storage. And this, of course, was also the time when contemporary art was starting to come into its own. Tate Modern was under construction. And Glenn Lowry, the director of the Museum of Modern Art, saw a natural affinity between, I think, his interests in bringing contemporary art more to the fore at MoMA and this institution down the street, as it were, in Long Island City, and approached Alana Heiss at the time about a merger and affiliation between the institutions. And Glenn's vision, I think, for that relationship has very much remained intact. And it's a relationship, in a sense, based in a provocation. You know, this idea that contemporary art is something that, or let's say, I don't know, art after 68, art after 89, wherever we want to draw this line, there's something about the way that contemporary art sort of sits within the modern art institution as something that can provoke it to be a more contemporarily engaged institution in a variety of ways that it works, not simply in and around the program itself. And so we play, I think, an important role in that process and sort of shifting. We have played an important role in shifting the way MoMA approaches a lot of different things. Our audience is much younger, much more local. We speak to different constituents in a certain sense, and we also have obviously a very different kind of structure and set of working parameters that allow us to work faster, be more topically engaged, things that are all important to the larger institution but can be best realized, I think, at our scale.
You get to be much more nimble.
We're specifically charged with being much more nimble.
So we are going to start the Even Eight by asking you what the most underrated show in New York right now is. What is the one thing that you would encourage people to sort of notice?
I'm bad with this question in the same way I'm bad with like top 10 lists. I guess the show that I would highlight, unfortunately, is a show that no one can see, which somehow feels fitting, which you can't see it because it closed a few weeks ago. But it was a show you would have had a hard time finding anyway, which was an exhibition put together by Olivia Shao, who runs a space called Doyers in little, basically a cubby hole in a basement, actually down some stairs on East Broadway. And it's hard to find unless you, even when you know what you're looking for. And she did an exhibition of books and ephemera by Stanley Brown, a great artist who unfortunately passed away a few months ago and who has very rigorously withheld details about his life, doesn't allow photographs. Didn't allow photographs of his work to be published. Biographical information couldn't be circulated. All of this, you know, cultivating what we now recognize as a kind of, I don't know, romantically reclusive kind of refusal that we associate with people, I don't know, like Tino, Seagal, or others. And so I think I'm perverting your question in a sense to say that I think Stanley is one of the most underrated artists.
So on the flip side, is there any show you think is overrated happening in New York right now?
I don't know if it's a show, but I would say the Ai Weiwei Fences project. You know, I think Ai Weiwei has his moments for sure, and is an important artist
and an important activist.
Yes, an important activist. That's where it gets, I guess, a little more complicated. I think sometimes the activism, it has a little less acuity and precision than the art does. And I think in this case, they were put together in a way that I think wasn't super effective. You know, it'd be different if he had built a fence that, you know, bisected Central Park north and south, just all the way across. That would have worked somehow. You know, you're going for your jog and you like going around the loop and boom, and then you have to walk, you know, all the way across the park or out to the Central Park West to get where there's an actual barrier that interrupts people's lives rather than like a piece of art made out of fences in pseudo public spaces around New York City, which mostly are just, you know, things you look at. I don't think that this particular, I don't know how many there were, over 100, something like this. There were tons of these fence things around New York, but in ways that abstracted the problem in the wrong way.
If that's going to be considered sort of ineffective, is there something sort of that you have seen recently develop in New York City that you were really excited about?
In a way, it has to do with art, but it turns away from that question a little bit, which I guess is the manner in which people have started working comfortably with art as a tool rather than as an ends for social justice. I guess that's a little confusing. What I mean is, take for example, Aggie Gunn's sale of her Lichtenstein painting and her concurrent establishment of this fund at the Ford Foundation to work in a variety of ways to address the crisis of mass incarceration. Obviously, she could have just sold the painting and quietly and turned around and set up the fund. But by connecting the two of them the way that she did, it reminded everybody that the, you know, $450 million being spent on a Leonardo painting, that those are abstractions that nevertheless have actual value, right? And the actual value is so easy to forget about because the numbers are so silly. Just for simply saying, not just, oh, well, I could buy like 20,000 kids school supplies for a year or these kinds of stats, but it actually just said this can go to this.
Right. Super direct.
In a very direct way. This full sum, as it were, although she didn't use the full value of the sale for the purpose of setting up the fund. She nevertheless said, here, this can go to this.
So moving in a slightly different direction, what is the most important book you've read or film you've watched recently?
I guess I would say two books, because I was going, and I'm actually not done with either of them. I'm sort of going back and forth between them. One is Jeff Chang's book on resegregation and Angela Nagel's book on the rise of the alt-right and sort of internet culture wars. That's called Kill All Normies. Both of them are books about delusion, kind of. Jeff Chang's book essentially tracks the period of what at least, you know, we and sort of the white liberal left think of as, you know, the years of advancement. Again, sort of self-congratulation, if that's our theme today. You know, particularly during the Obama era, as, you know, the era of diversity and inclusion. But in fact, as a time period that masks backsliding on many of the desegregation efforts of previous decades, also the propagandist casting of diversity as a cultural guilt initiative writ large, kind of, that, you know, it masks a lot of other problems while allowing corporations, you know, universities, et cetera, to feel good about changing at least the, you know, the look of their workforce or their products or their advertising or public facing things that are not actually addressing, and in fact in his analysis are worsening, underlying structural issues. And then the Kill All Normies book is sort of about, you know, in one summary, how the fun of internet meme culture has actually acted as a Trojan horse for the rise of the alt-right, that, you know, these things that that we pass around and engage with seems really great and fun and whatever is also, it camouflages a different kind of primitivizing behavior and set of desires that people have.
It sounds like if you could be an expert on any subject, it would be criminal justice reform, but I'll let you pick a different topic if you'd like.
The things that I would like to be expert at, I suppose, rather than expert on, the distinction being, you know,
you're a doer.
Well, right, to a certain degree, I'm interested in, or I'm most attracted to, those forms of knowledge that are things that you
become active.
You have to do. I'm not much of a sports person, although I was in my youth. I, you know, that sort of watching like an amazing basketball player or something, of just like, wow, how do they do that? That is just a physical knowledge that you've built up over the years. I think, you know, for me, that it would be something like construction or cooking or something, where what you learn is a craft, basically, you know, a physical activity somehow, in that, or playing a musical instrument.
Something that eventually feels innate.
Right. Something is just something that you do rather than something you know. And I think that speaks a lot just to my own sort of struggle with trying to stop thinking sometimes and be able to engage more directly with things.
So where do you take someone you're trying to impress?
Oh, I guess it depends who.
Not to your kitchen, I take it.
Well, no, the thing is, I do. I can build some stuff. I can cook some things. I can't really do much with the musical instruments I once knew how to play. But there's aspects of that I still, you know. But I get, you know, actually the James Turrell at Moma PS1 works on most people. Believe it or not. Yeah. I mean, it's in some ways this kind of, you know, I don't know, Zen retreat disco or something, but it has this real, it has a very primal effect that you can talk about, but you don't need to talk about.
Where do you go to be alone in New York?
Oh, movie theaters are good places.
Any favorites?
Well, when I lived in the East Village, I used to go to Sunshine because it was almost across the street from where I lived. And so you could also make a last minute decision like, oh, I guess we could ride across the street and see that movie and jump in even after it started.
After
didn't matter.
The previews.
And you can sit in the dark. And yeah, I mean, it's movie theaters are nice because it's dark. So you're sort of alone. I guess I'm a great fan of the Rose Reading Room at New York Public Library. Of course, there's usually other people there, but there's still something about.
Well, you're never actually alone in New York.
I guess you could be.
It's more of a mental space thing.
There are places in New York where you could be truly alone. I just tend to find places where I'm alone with other people, and that's that does the job for me.
I was going to say, you have access to the Terrell after hours, so.
Yes, and in fact, although I haven't done it before hours, James asked me when he was working on the new lighting program for us last year if we were interested in a dawn program. I said, oh, sure. But I haven't seen it. But I think it would be great at some point, you know, before hours, I'll try it. But yeah.
And last but not least, we want to ask, what is on your radar for the beginning of 2018?
Ooh.
Things we should all sort of keep a lookout for.
I mean, I have to go back to the China show at the Guggenheim, which I think is, there's lots there to study. And it's up for a while, so people should really, I think, look at that. There's a real, both Alexandra and Phil have important essays in that catalog about sort of the problem of contemporaneous, period, but contemporaneous in China means something very specific, and the history is different. So I have to go back to that show.
Alex and Phil being Alexander
Monroe. Alexander Monroe and Phil Tanari, who were the chief architects of that exhibition, also with Hu Hunru.
What's coming up at MoMA PS1?
Oh, what's coming up at MoMA PS1? We haven't actually announced our next round of shows, which open in April. Although, like sort of these other shows that people haven't seen, I encourage folks to come out and see our shows that have only been open a couple weeks now. Kathy Wilkes, who's never had a solo show in New York, has done a really great exhibition with us, her largest to date, and a huge Carolee Schneemann retrospective, which is
one of my favorites.
She's great. I mean, if anyone is looking for an artist through whom to read the hashtag MeToo moment, Carolee is perfect. In fact, there's a great piece that's in the exhibition. It's a work she made over a number of years, starting in, I think, 69 and running until maybe 75, where she and her friends tracked their sexual encounters with a variety of men in remarkable detail. And rated them and recorded all of this in
the original Lulu.
Exactly. and it's presented in these gridded charts, you know, that look very much like the systems work of many of her male peers during that time period, but in fact is, you know, profoundly and very intensely feminist as a result.
Thank you, Peter, so much for joining us on this very cold, very snowy morning in New York.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So quickly, just to recap, we want to thank Jacqueline Humphreys and Peter Ely for joining us on the show today. And if you haven't done so already, catch up on episodes 1 through 4 of Hidden Noise to figure out what exhibitions you should be seeing over the holiday break. And we will see you all in 2018.